Welcome to When the Bow Breaks with your host, Alexis Aralin.
I dealt with tons of confrontation. You know, I had a father who used confrontation as sport. He just started to get really, really angry with her. You know, there was always name-calling and belittling. It was never violence, but it was always like you were always aware that he could hurt you if he wanted to. Like, he made sure you knew that.
Kara Rexsmith, it's very, yep. Very nice to meet you. I'm very excited to be talking with you today.
Well, thank you. You as well.
So tell me a little bit about yourself, how you kind of came to hear about When the Bow Breaks.
Well, we're both involved in a Facebook group. I think it's called Podcaster Support Group. I never post there at all. I'm a member. I lurk as I do through much of my life. That sounds bad these days. But I lurk and I read everything, and I saw you posting about your show, and it's funny. I read a post that you wrote, and I was reading through the comments, and I was thinking about estrangement, and I went and looked. I was like, you know, I'm gonna go see what my dad has done on Facebook lately, and I popped, like, I'm not Facebook friends with him. But I went over and looked at his page, which is public, and saw his latest post and was like, oh, what am I doing? And then I emailed you.
Oh no. Yeah. I've been there. I've done that myself. So was it more kind of like therapeutic then?
I look at the podcast I do almost purely as therapy, even though I don't present it that way. Mm-hmm. But forcing myself out of my comfort zone and into a conversation and trying to create content, even if it's just really for me. I mean, I hardly even tell anyone I put it out. It's just the actual practice of doing it that I enjoy.
Yeah. No, I had a guest the other day. He was just telling me that he had started a podcast with his brother, whom he didn't really have a relationship with growing up. And so they didn't really know each other. And so they kind of started their podcast out of just trying to have a relationship with each other, but, you know, along the same time, you know, trying to come up with content. So again, like, it was kind of therapeutic for them. And the more and more I dug into podcasting personally, the more and more I found that there were so many people talking about some really, really cool things in a really, really interesting way. Can you tell me more about your show?
Mine is called Kerouac to the Future, and it's really all over the place. A couple of times I had some of my local stay-at-home dad friends over, and we, you know, we made a loose format of what we were going to do. We were mainly talking about technology. Mm-hmm. Technology and entertainment. But I couldn't really get them to commit to coming over, so I but I still wanted to record, and so I started going to our local library. Mm-hmm. And so episodes 3 and 4, I found homeless people at the library, and I took them to lunch and had an informal conversation with them at lunch and told them, you know, what I was thinking of doing. Mm-hmm. And then brought them back. One of them, we went back to the library to a study room. The other one, we went to a topiary garden that's the famous painting from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. The name I can never remember, but it's the springtime scene in the park.
Oh my gosh. I should know this. I'm like an art nerd, but I can't think of it off the top of my head. But yeah, I know what you're talking about.
We have a topiary garden here that is made to look like that painting.
Uh-huh.
If you look at, if you stand in the right place and look at the park, it's the painting.
That's cool.
So he and I, the second person, Thomas, he and I sat and we just had a discussion in the park so you can hear the birds and people walking by and stuff. It was,
Awesome. I like that.
A lot of the things I do are almost like pilots. So that was first names only with Kerouac, even though it is posted under Kerouac to the Future. which the whole Kerouac to the Future thing was just for a Doug Benson thing. He asked people who come to his show to bring a sign, like a poster that uses their name as a pun in a movie title.
Uh-huh.
And with my name, I didn't know what the heck to do. It's a weird name to try to work into a pun.
Yeah.
So I did that. And I, since I was starting my podcast around the same time I was going to a show, I figured I would just call it that and start. I keep hearing people, him and Haw, that they want to start a podcast and they don't actually get around to ever recording anything mm-hmm. or putting anything up. Mm-hmm. And one of the first pieces of advice that I got from a producer here in town was to put it up and get better. Like, just put it out there.
Yeah.
Keep working.
Yeah. I decided to keep in a couple of mistakes in my pilot episode because I wanted to remember those things and I wanted to remember where I was. I don't want to forget where I was. You know, I don't know how far this show is going to go. I really don't care either. I mean, I do care, but you know what I mean? That's not right. What drives me. You know, what drives me is just doing this, being here in the moment and talking with people like you. But I don't know what's going to happen. And it's just, but I want to appreciate, my growth and things like that. And that was something that is kind of new for me, is appreciating my growth, because I've never really been allowed to grow a whole lot, when I was younger and stuff. So I don't know if that strikes a chord with you or not, but.
Oh, it does. Although in my case, I don't think I particularly tried to grow a whole lot either. that's like the whole lurking thing, stay as anonymous as, now I sound like our president, stay as anonymous as my name will let me. A lot of that goes back to, to the issues I'm sure we'll get to, I dealt with tons of confrontation. I had a father who used confrontation as sport and thrived on it. So I've always been a peacemaker even before the confrontation. Like I'm always looking ahead to what I can do to avoid the problems.
Yeah. I felt the same way. Like you always feel like, okay, what's going to happen next? Like you always feel like you're getting ready for something. You don't know what.
Right.
Yeah.
Tell
me more about that.
If we're talking about the estrangement part, I think I have to unfortunately go all the way back to the beginning, because my mom was 18 when she had me. Mm-hmm. This was in 72. She had had a child 3 years before and put her up for adoption.
Mm-hmm.
She kept it with a different person. So she was married and they kept me. My dad left within a couple months after I was born. I dodged a bullet there, because he had insisted on naming me after his guru at the time. And remember, this is 72. People were, these were a couple of hippies with gurus. And my mom hated the name. So she's sitting there 8 months pregnant and finishing one of Jack Kerouac's books. And like, as she closes it, it hits her that Kerouac might be a name that she would like and she could sell him on. so she did, and he went for it. And, if I had grown up with the name that he had insisted I have and he disappeared, I think that would have been, I would have been pretty bitter, and I would have had a different life mm-hmm. potentially, almost certainly,
yeah.
to be honest. But within a year and a half or so, after he was gone, I think even less than that. I don't think I was even a year old before she remarried, and that's the guy who I have called dad all my life. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I didn't even know about the other guy until I was probably 7 or 8 or something, maybe a little younger. Mm-hmm. But this was, again, the 70s in Ohio, and the scene here was a lot of Quaaludes, and I was pretty much left alone. Like, I did what I wanted. I don't remember much supervision at all. We moved around a lot. The adults I was around, there was usually at least one person staying with us as well. Mm-hmm. But they were always high. Well, the opposite of high. They were real low all the time. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, I fended for myself. I ran around the neighborhood, did my own thing, went to school, did great. You know, I was a smart kid. I read everything in my house, mm-hmm. which was an eye opener that young.
Wow.
But when I was 9, mm-hmm. When I was 8 and a half, they divorced, and his new wife to be picked him up and they took off. And in the meantime, they had had another child, my brother, who was 6 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. And he wanted custody of his son. Uh-huh. So my mom, who was now close to a shut-in through the Quaaludes and sort of the fear of him and the fear of confrontation, right, and alcohol and other drugs, she said, well, you know, you can have him, but you have to take both of them. Mm. And so he moved to Florida, and they both got jobs and got a house, and they sent for us. So we got put on a plane and sent to go to Florida to go live with what was essentially my stepdad and his wife.
Wow.
At first I was still in the stage where I idolized him. He's a very, very smart person. And at least to me, he was still very idealistic. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say the lessons he gave me up until 10 or 11 were great life lessons in, because I didn't see the things that went on with him and my mom. I was always out on my own.
Yeah.
But it was always about, you know, treating everyone equally and, you know, believing in the best in people and, you know, always doing what's right, even when it hurts you, you know. Mm-hmm. But down there is I, you know, started to head into my teenage years, you know, and their honeymoon wore off. He just started to get really, really angry with her. You know, there was always name calling and belittling, and there was never violence, but there was always
verbal, a lot of it, or
a lot of verbal abuse.
Yeah.
Definitely with her, and then starting on us. But it was never violence, but it was always like you were always aware that he could hurt you if he wanted to. Like, he made sure you knew that. Mm-hmm. And around 12 or 13, it was actually 12 because that's when I got my first job.
Wow. What was your first job?
I worked at an ice cream shop. A Jamaican guy there named Mike owned a little ice cream shop. This is in West Palm Beach, Florida. And he saw me around the neighborhood. We were in a pretty bad neighborhood. This is now we're in the 80s, and
yeah,
we were in the height of crack. And,
yes.
And we were what everyone around us called crack town.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I got at 12 years old, I was held up at gunpoint twice. the only times I've ever been held up at gunpoint, but they were both there and, you know, within a few blocks of my house. Mike had seen me around the neighborhood. He recognized me, and I don't know why, but he asked me if I wanted to come clean up his shop for 2 hours every day for $6 or $7 or something total.
Really?
And he'd give me a sub and an ice cream. So, you know, I took that, I started getting my own money and, you know, mm-hmm. one of my meals taken care of every day. And I did it 7 days a week for 2 years. Like that was
wow.
just, I'm very into routine like that. Once I establish something, I do it every day. When I run, right now I'm out of shape, but as soon as I decide to get into shape and start running, I will run 4 miles every day until I stop.
Wow.
And once I miss a day, I'm toast. it's the worst.
I'm like that too. I have to have a routine. If I don't, like, it just takes me forever to get back going again.
Oh, me too. I have to commit for the long haul.
Yeah.
So that's what I usually do is I'll balloon up to 200 pounds and then I'll run 4 miles a day for 5 months and then I'll be 165 and then I say, I don't need to run. And then I won't for a year and a half.
No, I hear a lot of running is great. Like I had a friend who started running and he started like changing the way he ran and, I don't know. Something happened to him and he just became a different person. And he just said that he really loved just running. And I don't know, running just what it does for some people. I just think it's really neat. I can't run myself. I have a bad knee, but,
I like it when I'm doing it, when I'm about that second week of when I start something like that, then I'm great.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that first week of it, I don't like it at all.
Yeah. It kills you.
But I worked for him for 2 years. He always made sure I had money in my pocket. He actually tracked down one of the people who robbed me at gunpoint, and because I knew who it was, and uh-huh. I told him about it. He actually, because he was friends with the police there, helped me file the police report. Found the person. They went to prison.
You were 12? You were how old?
I was 12.
You were 12? Yeah. And this guy, I like him already. So you're working for him and he takes you to help you file a police report?
He called a friend of his in the police force to come and take my report. And then after the report was filed, a couple days later, one of his network of neighborhood locals said, hey, I saw the guy and he called the same police officer. Police officer showed up. We took a ride down the street to where he was standing outside.
Wow.
And the police arrested him. He pled guilty. And I got a letter a few months later saying that he was serving like a 2-year prison sentence for it.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, Mike was a great guy. Until I left Florida, I always stayed in touch with him. He's one of my young role models.
I'm loving this right now. I'm sorry. I have to stop you just for a second. I'm loving this right now because as I'm starting this show, I'm still kind of new. So like as podcaster to podcaster, I guess I'm just loving this because people are able to talk about this stuff and they're able to talk about how they're helping other people. And at the same time, we get to talk about the good people in our lives who did something, who gave a shit. You know what I mean? And
absolutely.
I don't know. I love this. I didn't want to like interrupt you too much, but I really just had to say that this is really neat. Just keep going. You're doing awesome. I love this story. I love listening to you talk about this. It's just, I don't know. It's really cool. Keep going.
I appreciate it. I wish there were more people out there who knew about people like Mike. At 12 years old coming from Ohio and, you know, really poor upbringing. Like I had a very limited sort of diet and palate. Like I didn't know about much else, but working for him, I'd get my normal sub every day, but when he was cooking oxtails or jerk chicken or fish head stew or something like that,
wow,
he would give it to me. And, mm-hmm. and I got to eat, you know, some of these things that at the time seemed crazy to me. And now I'm here in Columbus, and whenever a new little, you know, strip mall Jamaican shop opens, I have to go and try all their stuff to see how it stacks up.
That's awesome.
And now I'll eat anything. And whenever I go anywhere, if I go to Mexico or somewhere, then I will eat whatever the locals are eating, whatever's on a cart. If I see other people eating it, I will too, because I don't care. Like I don't feel above any of it, and I get to try some amazing stuff.
Yeah, I've tried some like really interesting stuff. I had to like go on a really, really restrictive diet, but then that also like led me to like try other things I'd never tried before. And so now I'm always like, ooh, let me try it. And it's just,
absolutely.
Yeah, my kids think I'm crazy. They're like, what are you eating? You know, like I'm having a bowl of quinoa and they're like, Mom, you have worms in your dish. And I was just like, that's so gross. It's like, thanks, right. You know, for making my meal so nice. But yeah, I love food. I'm always ready to talk about that too. I should probably start a whole other podcast about food.
Right.
Anyway, go on. Keep going.
So anyway, around that time is as I'm, feeling not only the independence of, your parents don't care where you are, but I can start taking care of myself. I can start mm-hmm. buying the things I want. And I don't have to, I don't have to depend on these people for me. I started to realize that as soon as I was done with high school, that's it. In my 12, 13 year old brain, I knew that I was stuck with them through high school mm-hmm. and that when I was done with that, I could, I could be off on my own and I wouldn't be beholden to them. Mm-hmm. And so from 12 on, I worked, I went to school, I went to high school. I didn't try very hard. I had been a pretty exceptional student going through gifted up through eighth grade. Once I got to high school and had sort of committed to just being out on my own, I did fine. I mean, it's not hard to get, all B's in the Florida school system.
Yeah.
And I did it, throughout, but I never took the SAT, the ACT, anything like that. I never bothered even thinking about college. All I thought about was in June of 1990, I'll be 17 years old, but I'll be out of high school and I'll be able to leave.
Yeah.
And so, I always had at least one job going at all times. And I didn't particularly save money. I just got more used to getting all my own meals and buying my own clothes, making my own decisions.
Yeah, just being independent.
Buying my own first car and second car, like doing all that stuff, getting enough money together to have rent for when I moved out. Mm-hmm. And so sure enough, I graduated, I moved out the next day and, started looking around for work, found a job in a factory and stayed there for 7 years and just, lived like a 17 year old till a 24 year old in South Florida who isn't, isn't beholden to anything and can, party it up and sort of escape from everything. Around then, I had through all that, he got worse and my stepmother was no prize either. I as I'm older now, I realize what she was going through and that times that she would lash out at me or like wake me up at 1 a.m. to yell at me while she's drunk for whatever reason was because she was scared of him and she needed someone. Like it's the whole trickle down thing. Right. Mm-hmm. At the time I completely resented her. But as I got older, it and realized what he really was, I just more pitied her than anything.
Yeah.
And she got worse and worse and she was the main provider. I mean, he worked part-time in a print shop, usually knocked off by noon to go drink and just wouldn't go back to work you know, woke up and drank, stayed pretty drunk the whole time, but was very good at handling it. You know, he was way better than her at handling it for sure.
He could hold his liquor better.
Yeah. And when you just stay in that state all the time, you get pretty good at it.
Yeah. Oh, I know. We had alcoholism in my family too.
Well, yeah. I mean, hell, I'm still, you know, I drink and I stay very aware of it, but I'm also a creature of habit who loves routine. So I probably do it too much, but I do stay aware of it. And I, you know, tell myself all the time, I point out what I'm doing and I build in like what I feel like are safeguards. They're probably more like signs of alcoholism when I won't do it while my kids are awake. I won't, or at least I won't ever be drunk while they're awake. They've never seen me drunk. And you know, that's important to me, even if it's probably a warning sign.
No, but it's awareness is key though. Like, you know, we all have something we're working on and we all have something that we're struggling with, and awareness is so important. I mean, I remember when I didn't have that, I was just totally doing just whatever. I mean, I never got into drugs or alcohol because I saw what it did to my brother, but I kind of went the other way and just, you know, got caught up in just not even just suppressing all my feelings and everything. And I wasn't really aware of my own behavior, you know, when I was lashing out and things like that. And so I think that as a kid, you expect your parents to be so, you know, controlled and everything. And then when they're not, you know, you get angry, like you're not supposed to yell at me in the middle of the night when you're drunk, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So and then as a parent myself, you know, I see that, you know, I see parents more, you know, they're more humanized than they were, you know, when I was 4 and 5 years old and stuff like that. And, but I think it's good because you are taking note of it and you are like thinking about it and you are trying to establish boundaries and taking step to improve it or, you know, to keep it from getting worse. And I think that that's good.
Yeah, I think so. Through all of this, as I'm living there, every couple of years or so, I would get sent back up to Ohio to spend time with my mom. Mm-hmm. And she was always a disaster. She was the, self-destructive drunk. I'm pretty certain who was just hoping that one of the nights she wouldn't wake up. Hmm. And I say drunk, but I mean, she would do anything. She didn't care. But I always loved her. I remembered, you know, her from my childhood, you know, when they were still together, that like, the good memories I do have of being home were times with her and you know we were pretty close for what it was. Mm-hmm. And you know it would when I would come up for a summer or a visit or something like that, I'd always come back and be dismayed and he would, you know, then he'd have two grown women to disparage in front of me all the time, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, he'd be telling me how awful she was and has always been and how awful his new wife or now current wife was.
Yeah.
But I never, as much as I ignored the bashing of the current wife, like I resented the bashing of my mom. But eventually, you know, when I just, as I got older, I got so tired of trying to deal with my mom and realizing that, you know, one of these days she was just going to be dead. And so something flipped in my brain and I just decided she was, and it would be a lot easier if I thought of it that way. And so she and I just fell out of touch for, I don't know, 7 years or so. Mm-hmm. I think she showed up maybe once or twice in that time. Like she came down to Florida, mm-hmm. but But I'd maybe go to lunch and it would be very perfunctory, and then and then she'd be gone, and I wouldn't have to think about it again, and she'd just go right, like, it was almost like we just had a little episode, and then I went right back to ignoring that she existed.
Yeah.
But she, I believe, well, I know actually it was 99. She and her current husband now got sober. They've been sober for 20 years. For what they do, they're pretty successful. She works for the city and has for 20 years. He's an HVAC guy, and they're incredibly supportive of each other. They're 1,000% non-judgmental of me. And, they're very, very respectful of the boundaries that with my family and, uh-huh, and my children.
Uh-huh. Did they ever have counseling for that? I mean, I don't know. It sounds like they would have. I don't know. They sound like, maybe they had some counseling, like respecting your boundaries and everything. But that's really cool.
I think it's part of the AA program, at least the way they took it in.
Uh-huh.
I think those two being together for it and realizing for her, like, how much she had given up.
Uh-huh.
I was married a few years after I was married in 2003. So she'd been sober for 4 years. I think we'd been talking again for two.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't tell her I was getting married or invite her or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might have set a baseline there. But I wasn't ready to be disappointed, and I wasn't 100% sold on it yet.
Yeah.
I think when I got sold on it with her for sure was after we had our first son, which would have been 2005. She came to visit. We were living in Virginia at the time, mm-hmm, Northern Virginia. And she and her husband drove over to come visit. They asked, she was already trying to be as respectful as she could. She's like, anytime I can come, you just tell me if it's 2 hours or a week or whatever, we'll stay somewhere else. We'll take whatever we can get. She came to visit, and she still smoked a lot then.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife told her, as soon as she got there, you're not holding the baby unless you are wearing clean clothes and you're washed. Like, he had been born with some difficulties. Mm-hmm. He's great now, but he was a month early, so.
Mm-hmm.
So there were issues, but so she would, she'd go through the whole routine to do it. But then, one of the first times she was holding him, he just kept coughing, and, mm-hmm, and she gave him back, and she didn't smoke much at all the rest of the trip there,
uh-huh,
smoked like a chimney the whole way back to Ohio and then never smoked again.
Wow.
She was, and she was like, next time you see me, you're not going to have to worry about it at all. And she just stopped. And that was like her crutch for quitting alcohol was, at least I can still smoke.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she threw it all out because she didn't want something there that was in the way and that she felt like it was selfish to even want to do it. And so at that point I was like, you know what? You're welcome anytime, and I'm really glad that you're in their lives,
uh-huh,
or in his life at the time. We had a second sense.
Mm-hmm.
But so that was my estrangement with her, which was largely just by not being near each other, and it was pretty elective. Just like when she gave me away, because that made it easy for her to go do what she wanted to do.
Right.
And she knew that at the time I idolized him. She probably thought I was in better hands. And honestly, I mean, maybe I was.
Are you enjoying When the Bow Breaks? If so, visit us on Facebook. Like and share.
But I don't feel like that's as true an estrangement as it is with my dad, mm-hmm. who the last time I saw him was when I lived in LA in 2002-ish, and I brought him out. I wanted him to meet my wife, to be mm-hmm. My fiance, and he basically got there and just tried to start a fight with everything, anything and everything. He says he's being devil's advocate, but he's really just trying to goad you into the argument that he craves.
Huh.
And I've gotten way better at avoiding conflict in this time. So I'm not taking any of his bait. I think he was there for 4 days. And by the second half of it, I'm just not talking. He can say whatever he wants, and I'm just not answering. And
you're just like gray rocking it. Have you heard that term?
No.
It's like they
what
call
is
it.
That?
Well, I grew up in a very narcissistic, like abusive home, and there's this term called gray rocking it, where you just try not to respond to somebody who is trying to like pick at you. And you know how they say, oh, just ignore the bully or whatever. Well, this is kind of a like more severe form of it, like just pretending like it doesn't bother you, like I don't know, kind of passive, maybe shut right. down kind of.
Yeah, like being stone, just yeah, that makes sense. But it got to the point where he just to try to goad me into a response, I remember it distinctly. There was something on the news, and they showed a black suspect from a crime, right?
Uh-huh.
And he turns and he's like, you know, if we just sent them all to prison, we wouldn't have to deal with this. And I'm like, you know, you could stay somewhere else.
Yeah.
I'll buy a hotel. Like I'll pay for a hotel room. He's like, oh, you disagree? And I'm like, oh, I can't do this. So yeah. I actually left my own apartment and went somewhere else, just went driving around or walking or something.
Yeah.
I used to walk a lot there for some reason, even though nobody walks in LA.
Walking in LA.
Right. So I just gritted my teeth till I could drive him back to the airport the next day or 2 days later, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And he went back, and really I just stopped interacting with him. I wouldn't not answer the phone if he called or something like that for the first couple years.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when I moved back across coast to Virginia, where you know, where we had our first kid, it was when we had him, and you know, I knew like my wife's parents were coming to visit, and my mom was coming to visit, and I thought, if he tries to come here, like, and poison my family,
yeah,
I can't, like, I just can't have that. And yeah. So I just avoided it at first. You know, he kept asking when I was going to come down there, and you know, he would try and call, and if I accidentally answered the phone or something like that, it'd just be super curt and cut it off.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2009 had our second son, and around the same time, the daughter that he had with my stepmother, who was 16 years younger than me, we're fairly estranged as well, because we grew, you know, we called each other brother and sister, but we shared absolutely no blood. And and she was there for, you know, the last few months before I moved out and
yeah,
went off on my own.
Yeah.
And she also adores him. But but around the around that time, she was going to school for, she was trying to get into a school for visual effects. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I ever mentioned that they were also, the dad and stepmom were also very bad with money and managed to mortgage an $80,000 house they bought in 1980 into a $345,000 debt.
Like they were
doing that and living, you know, constantly refinancing and getting money out of it and somehow being allowed to. So, you know, they were crazy in debt, and he called, and I, for some reason, answered, and he was telling me that she wanted to go to school, and he wanted me to be the co-signer on her loan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanting to do right by the sister, I called an attorney, showed him the loan that they were showing me, and he said, if she drops out, you're on the hook for all of this. And then they can collect it immediately. You're immediately on the hook if she screws this up.
Yeah.
The way this loan is worded.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called him back and I said, you know, I've talked it over with my family and my lawyer, and I'm not gonna do it. And just, I got the full brunt of what a woman would have gotten. Like to him, I had dropped to the level of woman, which is just the worst in his mind.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe even a black woman. Like, and this is all, like, this is me projecting to him. This is not how I feel. Remember, I'm the guy who likes to interview homeless people and buy them lunch and take them out to nice places. So he let me have it. And again, it was a lot of the themes from when I was a kid about, you know, that I was selfish and I only cared about me. And I didn't care about family and, you know, giving my everything to the family and that I was going to die, you know, I was going to die alone and lonely and, you know, good luck with that. And I was, you know, so I hung up and, you know, a couple of days later calls again, asked if I've reconsidered. This was like just a voicemail, you know, like a voicemail that was like, you know, hope you've changed your mind, whatever. And then morphed into you piece of trash, you selfish, worthless person.
Like
all without me even being there. So at that point, I've never talked to him since. I get an email once in a while because unfortunately my email is real easy to figure out. So I get one from him once in a while that just says, you know, like, hey, don't understand why you think your life was so bad. And you know, I think my life is fantastic now, like getting him out of it and, you know, getting, meeting my wife, getting married and realizing that I wasn't beholden to any sort of family that was thrown on me as a kid who had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that I can just have my bedrock family here and let in who I want was probably the most empowering thing of all this.
Yeah.
You know, like realizing you know, you don't have to make way for toxic people in your life. It's like the argument that you hear a lot now that, you know, that you have to give all viewpoints, a chance to tell you what they think. But, you know, I don't have to listen to someone disparage, other genders or the idea of gender fluidity or other mm-hmm. races or, you know, or any, whatever other you want it to be. I don't have to listen to you disparage them because that's not a worldview. That's not something that I have to give credence to.
Yeah.
And it's the same way with him. I don't have to let him in, just by virtue of he used whatever portion of his paycheck to supply food and let me live in his house when, I never really had a say in the matter.
Yeah. So after you stop talking to your dad, like, what is your life? I mean, I know you say your life is great. Well, tell me about tell me about how things change after you leave a toxic relationship.
I poured myself, after the initial 7 years or so of factory work and drinking and clubbing in South Florida, I managed to still never went to school. I managed to weasel my way into a sports clerk job at the Palm Beach Post, mm-hmm. which was the paper I read growing up. I loved the paper, and I loved sports. I had a Michael Jordan tattoo on my leg. I got in there and they gave me this part-time job as an agate clerk, which is like typing in box scores, mm-hmm. Taking the phone call from the high school coaches so that they can report their results, that sort of thing. And then uh-huh. writing like a little 2-paragraph story based on it.
Yeah.
So that was the job, and they said, it was 30 hours a week, $7 an hour. It was a contract position, wasn't, no benefits. So I poured myself into that. I did that. I went in probably 70 hours a week, even though I was only working 30, and I just learned as much as I could. This would have been 97, 98. Mm-hmm. And I got a call. My favorite person at that job, a senior editor at the paper, left to go to CBS Sportsline on the internet.
Uh-huh.
And was laughed out of the building. But he was also the guy who, when I was trying to learn what it was like to be an editor, and a writer, he was the guy who helped me and gave me answers and listened to my questions. Right.
Uh-huh.
So a few months after he left, it was the weirdest thing. I went to the boss of the sports department and I said, "Hey, I've been here for a year and a half now. I think I'm learning, and I'd love to be an editor someday. I'm not talking about today, but is there any chance I can ever work full time here?" And he said, "Well, do you have a degree?" I said, "No, I don't. I just come here." And and he said, "Well, no, we only hire college graduates full time." So I said, "Well, I guess I quit. Like, here's my 2 weeks. I'm giving you 2 weeks notice." And mm-hmm. I went back and sat at my desk wondering what the hell, like, how I'm going to find some new career that. And I got a phone call, and it was the guy who had been, like, literally after that conversation, I sat down and I got a call, and it was the guy who had been laughed out of the building. He's still at CBS Sportsline.
Uh-huh.
CBS had the Nagano Olympics that year, the Winter Olympics. And they were going to ramp up to give it a good online presence.
Yeah.
And they wanted some full-time temps for 3 months while they did it to mm-hmm. help bolster the staff. Uh-huh. And he said, "Is there any chance you could do it? I know you'd probably have to leave there, but who knows? It might lead to something."
Yeah.
And I said, "Hey, I could start in 2 weeks." And I worked in sports media on the internet for the next 20 years. Well, wow. Almost 20. Yeah. 19 years. I got laid off a year and a half ago.
Uh-huh.
And most of that I worked at foxsports.com.
Uh-huh.
They were one of the companies who did the whole pivot to video thing.
Yeah.
And because of Facebook inflating video views and that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason they did it, I don't mind. I was ready to go by then. I made a joking post on Facebook after I got laid off that I made it almost 20 years on the internet, and that was my first layoff. I had survived all the others. Certainly in internet media, they're like AOL for a while there did a layoff every year.
Yeah.
I survived at least four at Fox. But this time I really wanted to go, and I was petrified they were going to keep me because then I'd, you know, either have to stay and suck it up or quit. And, you know, that's such a problem to have, that I'd have to stay and have a, you know, pretty lucrative salary. Meanwhile, I didn't even mention the last 12, 11 years I was there, I was working remotely here in Columbus, Ohio. So I was just working out of my basement. I would do from 5 a.m. till noon, 6 days a week. And I would be alone. They were all West Coast. I was the only East Coast person. So I pretty much, I would get to do stuff on my own. They would show up. People there would start showing up on the last couple hours of my shift.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd get to hand my stuff off and I'd get to leave on time. They actually had to like stay late and work, you know, real hours of like, I say real hours, but you know, when I was in office, I would put in 10, 12, 13 hour shifts all the time. But now I was just doing my shift and being done.
Mm-hmm.
And
that sounds nice to me.
Well, yeah,
I'm done.
Be done. See at ya. Noon, and then catch a nap for 3 hours, and then when I get up, my kids are coming home from school, and I've got from 3 o'clock on with my kids. Like I didn't.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, I got the perks of being a stay-at-home dad and a paycheck, and it was great. And I'll tell you, the 5 a.m. start did a great job of curbing my worst tendencies, you know?
Yeah.
Because
because
I was dedicated to the routine of, heck, I like six days a week because it only gave me one weekend day to mess up.
Yeah, yeah, to feel like you're off.
Right. So
yeah.
So when the time came and they laid me off, it was fine. I had a 16-month buyout, I think. Like 16 months of pay, I got in a lump sum. So,
nice.
You know, grabbed the kids, took a road trip in the summer, and we went all around the South. Drove around, visited old friends, and visited my brother, the one who's 6 years younger than me. Visited him down in Tallahassee. Spent a few days there. Got to go see the why am I blanking on the name? It's in Nashville. There's another one in Parthenon. Went to the Parthenon in Nashville. Do you know about that?
Mm-hmm. I've heard about it. Yeah.
It's wild. Going in there, it's like being transported. It's pretty cool. So, you know, we got to do that sort of stuff. And it was so funny. Just like when I, at the paper, when I quit and sat down at my desk and was offered a life-changing job. While we were here, my wife, who is in pharma, she also has worked from home this whole time. My kids have never seen anyone go to work. her company, we knew my layoff was coming. At least we hoped I would make the cut. She had been working as a contractor for them through this whole time as a consultant. And they said, we are cutting out contractors. And if you want to stay with us, you have to go full time. She had been consulting 32 hours a week. So she did 4 days, had Thursdays off. They said, basically you have to start working Thursdays and get benefits.
Oh, darn.
And we'll still pay you your same amount because now we're not going to pay the company that's taking the cut through you.
Right. Yeah.
So literally when HR called to let me go, she was upstairs in her office. I just sent her a message on GChat to hey, here's the layoff. And I was on the phone with HR for about half an hour, and she had already told her HR person, because she went full time 2 weeks before that, and they switched our insurance over.
That's funny.
So
it was just like smooth.
Right. So now I'm focused. I don't want to do sports media, which is what I'm doing right now. I'm freelancing for a new sports media company. Mm-hmm. But I'm barely doing anything. It's an old friend, a guy from Sportsline who started his own company, wanted some help. And I said, sure, I'll try it out. They were giving me like 32 hours a week. And I was like, you know, I don't want to do it that much. Like, I don't want to freelance that much. So
that's a lot of work to freelance full time.
Right. So instead I just set some boundaries. I said, look, I'm not doing any more late nights. It affects me too much. It goes into the next day when I'm staying up late to make sure that we've got all the West Coast stuff covered and I'm going to sleep four. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So I said, if you want, I'll work mornings. And you know, I'll work up to four mornings a week, 4 hours, four-hour days a week. And I've even cut it back since then. Now I've got it that I'll only do it like Friday, Saturday, Sunday for 4 hours. And mm-hmm. really it was getting in the way of other things I wanted to do. I wanted to, you know, I'm not going crazy with the podcast thing, but I do mine. I produce another one for a local doctor here who's dealing with ovarian cancer. She wanted it mm-hmm. as a way to keep her friends and family and employees and stuff aware of what's going on in her life, but without having to like talk to people all the time.
Yeah.
So you know, she and I work together, and I you know, I edit, record, produce hers, and we came, you know, we came to a deal there. So I guess I freelance for her as well. Mm-hmm. I started a little LLC here to, you know, to work all this through. And now, you know, I'm not all that aggressive about finding customers or starting podcasts or even developing my own all that much. I do a lot of other stuff. I'm finding a lot more value in my time volunteering places. I do at least one day a week as an escort at a Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. And I've met a lot of it's unfortunately it's mostly women who are involved in the reproductive rights scene, but I've met all these women now that are strong activist women that like that would never have put up with the stuff that I saw as a kid, you know, and I see what they care about, and I see that they're 10 times more passionate and active as me, and yet, you know, I could show up one day a week and I'm like a hero, you know. Like, it's the funniest thing. I feel like I'm just becoming a lot more aware of all this. So now,
no, I like that you bring that up, because it's true. It's like, it should not be a segregated issue, because pregnancy is not it's not necessarily a spontaneous thing unless you're the Virgin Mary.
Right.
You know,
right.
We need more men involved in that. I think it's great.
Nobody tried to talk me out of my vasectomy, much less yell at me or call me a murderer. And, you know, if you really think about it.
Right.
Theoretically, a vasectomy eliminates the chance for way more pregnancies, right, than an abortion. Yeah. Like, that's just one. Like, my vasectomy, there are an untold number of pregnancies I could have caused after that, right? and I've shut off the world from all of them. But, you know, I'm a middle-aged white dude. I mean, I could flip sides and they would take me in a heartbeat. You know? But I've just been, you know, that we, the whole family does one night a week. We work together in I call it a soup kitchen downtown. It's billed as a community meal. Mm-hmm. But it's basically a bunch of volunteers at a church who will feed anyone who comes in. And I just started taking both kids there and my wife, because not that my wife needed any lessons in it, but like my kids needed to know that their world isn't reality for a lot of people, that we've sheltered them from a lot of it. Like, I grew up pretty hardened dealing with what was going on in my own family and what I saw in my neighborhood. And these kids are, you know, if they break their Xbox controller, chances are I'm going to go get a new one that day because, you know, they got to sleep sometime and I want to play too. But like, I wanted them to see that there are kids here who don't have any idea of a life like that. Right. They're seeing these people. And it's been, especially for my older one, it's been huge. He's very empathetic, and he's morphed into a very capable volunteer there, where he'll take any job on the list, whatever they ask him to do. There's not one on the list that he can't handle. Right. Uh-huh. And he now goes off on his own. My younger one is only 10. He still stays with either me or mom or one of the other volunteers who are there every week that we've gotten to know. Right. And again, that's like, I'm an atheist. I grew up not religious at all. The only reason I would do this is that I feel like this church is in it for the right reasons. They have a lesbian associate pastor, although it's a Methodist church. So we'll see how long that lasts after this week, but they accept anyone. They've got a family shelter under the church for single women or single moms. This church is not making money. It's there for the people, and nobody there's ever tried to preach any dogma to me or anything at all. Like I consider them friends, and I support what they need for their beliefs is fine by me, because I'm as pro-choice about that as anything else. Mm-hmm. But I just find more value in that. I love being flexible and able to jump in and help out anywhere around town. We had a Confederate rally at our state house last week. Ohio. We were the Union. we have a KKK rally coming to Dayton in a month or two. Like, jeez. I'm so astonished by all this that it feels disingenuous to go out there and try and get a regular 9-to-5 and you know, go hang out in some office and pretend I'm something I'm not now. I'm trying to learn how to be what I am.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally like relate with you on that level, because all my life I was driven by somebody else's purpose for what they wanted for me to do for them, you know, and I was never allowed to explore my own desires and my own dreams. I had them, but they were locked tight. And it wasn't until, you know, I became estranged from my parents, 32, I think. And I didn't even know who I was, because I had been so used to being who they wanted me to be. And once I got away from that, I started to kind of step into like my support groups and stuff. And even though it wasn't fun listening to everyone talk about how painful it was for them, I couldn't stay out of those groups. I had to be there, and I had to listen, and I had to talk. And so I feel like I'm just kind of bringing it to a broader audience. I mean, not like I want everyone listening to my stuff,
right,
but just because I want everyone to have the opportunity to say, hey, this is me, this is who I am, and this is what I can do. Can you please let me help, or help me achieve this? You know, let me help you, and just, you know, respect each other. It's just, it shouldn't be that difficult.
No.
You know?
It's funny, because I was thinking when we talked about doing this, that one of the things I saw you mention was that there was sort of a focus on what resources could help somebody, or, you know, mm-hmm. something like that. And when I consider the dead to be my real estrangement. And like, I don't want any resources to fix that. Like, I fixed it.
Yeah. Yeah. Not even fix it, but you know, like handle like the feelings that you get, you know, like sometimes, like I'm sure maybe for you, it was, you were so ready to just like cut it off, you know? And for me, like I wasn't quite ready emotionally. I think, I don't know, just cause maybe I'm more like a super emotional person, but you know, I had to take some time to like detach emotionally from them. And like, that was hard. And I was like, I don't know how to do this. How do I not be someone's daughter anymore? You know? And I think you were probably so used to kind of just being on your own. Like you said, you were like independent and everybody just kind of let you do what you wanted. Well, you know, a lot of things for me were dictated. And so, you know, I didn't have that kind of freedom. And I guess what I mean by resource is more like, I want to like create a buffet, I guess, like take what you need and like leave the rest for somebody else. And so, you know, that's why every person I talk to, I love what they're doing. I love hearing about them and I love hearing what they accomplished and what they went through and what they're doing now, because it gives me assurance that I'm, you know, doing an okay thing, you know?
Right. I think giving yourself permission to do it is the biggest thing. Like the thing I struggled with so much was sort of releasing the shackles of ownership. Like feeling like they had some sort of right to me, just because that's in my mom's case, because she happened to give birth to me. And in this guy's case, because he'd been given me. Like I was never adopted.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, were there any, like,
no
papers signed? You were just there.
They were aging wannabe hippies that you know, could do something like that. It was a different time for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you could do that today, but I doubt it would be as likely.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun.
There's too many cameras.
It's
for just someone to just leave their kid with somebody nowadays. And you know, right. Like they want to know your kid's social security number and, you know, I don't know. Yeah. It just amazes me how you just like went through that and no one even knew that like you weren't with a parent or like a biological parent.
Right. And it's funny. Like I told my wife earlier tonight, we just had our 16th anniversary.
Congratulations.
When I told her, I was like, you know, I'm a little nervous. Like, I don't tell really anyone my story. I tell you and that's about it. She's like, you don't even tell me. I said I have told you. I said, just, you know, it's in bits and pieces and you've been present for like, she was a big help in getting me to realize I don't owe people anything, that I'm allowed to have some, you know, some reasonable success in my life without feeling like I have to, give it all to them, or also give all my emotional availability to them, like, or let them affect, or let them affect my emotional availability at home, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, for sure.
But I, you know, I do, I like randomly, I'll tell her stories and she just, she just wants to cry. And to me, it's like, we passed a Wendy's the other day and I don't remember what about it made me say something, but I told her about being eight or 9 years old. It was before I went to Florida. It was here in Ohio. And, you know, I was hungry and I would go sometimes days without really ever seeing my parents sometimes at that point. Mm-hmm. But we lived at my grandmother's house. There was stuff there if I really needed to eat or something. But for a while, I saw that Wendy's was doing one of those peel-off games on their cups and on their fries.
Yeah.
And so I would go hang out at Wendy's and I would watch people eat. And if they didn't do their pull-up prizes, because I think that sort of thing was pretty new around then. I think that sort of marketing technique. if they weren't doing it, I would go over and ask them if I could throw away their stuff. And and then I would on the way I'd sneak off the strips and throw all their stuff away and see if I won any food. Or if they, you know, threw it away and didn't let me, or if I saw it, like I was very keen. I was always good at watching everyone around me and paying attention to what they were doing. And so if I saw someone throw one away, you know, I'd wait till they left, wait till employees weren't, you know, walked away from the register for a moment, and I'd go reach in the trash, grab it, see if I got something. And, you know, I'd get a couple burgers and a Frosty and a fry and then I'd go back to doing whatever I wanted and, you know, make it home in time to sleep and get up for school. Like, and I'd probably go days like that without, you know, and it wasn't that I was, you know, Dookie from season 4 in The Wire having to, you know, having to do this. I'm certain I had family members, aunts and uncles and my grandma that would have made sure I always had something. But like, I don't know. This was a way to eat too, you know? And so to me, like, I tell her the story and, you know, she grew up on campus at Stanford. Like, her parents are real professional people. And like the stories like that give her a totally different feeling than they do for me. It's nostalgic for me. It's me living by my wits. You know?
You're thinking, oh, they're throwing free food in the garbage. What the heck? Like, right. I'm going to go get it. And then, like, you know, when I tell my husband things, you know, that I did, he's like, what the fuck?
Right.
Like, what were you doing? Like, you shouldn't have ever had to get to that point. And then I'd be like, yeah, but I did and I survived, you know, and yeah, gosh.
Now I would.
So every time you see a Wendy's now,
I never would have reached in and taken food out of there. I want to make that clear. Like this was in
I
my mind,
wouldn't have either.
eight, nine year old, whatever entrepreneurial skills. Like I can, Wendy's is delicious and I can eat it for free because these suckers don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
That's what I did. Yeah. It's a miracle. Yeah. It's a miracle I was not abducted in the 70s, like, because I was I spent all my time out among random adults and, you know, just taking, you know, taking care of myself, you know. And I'm not a big guy. I was never, you know, I don't think I won many fights. I evaded almost any kind of trouble. So you know, it's funny now to be raising a couple of kids who are, you know, again, I was pretty smart. I let a lot of it go to waste in terms of schooling, but now I've got two kids that are smarter than I ever was, and you know, watching them learn a whole different way than I did, because you know, mine was so experiential and necessary. Like, you know, I don't want to say necessary for survival. I cringe at it overselling it, you know. It was just, but there are times when we're at that meal on Wednesday night and, you know, there are couple people, it's usually fine. Every now and then we get someone who's troubling and starts a fight or something, and
yeah,
and I see everything happening around me, and I look at my kids who have never felt threatened or in danger for real, like
yeah.
And I wonder about it. But I'm sure I get evidence all the time that they're going to be just fine, and that, you know, you adapt to the world you're growing up in. Hell, I am more scared of the world that they're growing up in than the one I did. And I'm not even talking about, like, politics.
Like the internet too. There's some crazy stuff on the internet, like after kids.
Absolutely.
And stuff. Scary.
But the internet and the the drugs that you can run into today, the mm-hmm. you know, fringe groups and people that can convince you of things, like they're growing up. Like we had years at a time, we had long stretches where nothing really changed. You know, the summer of 1981 was no different really than the summer of 1982 for a 10-year-old, right?
Where yeah.
Things are changing for these kids all the time. And they're being totally dismissed by a large swath of adults as entitled and useless and bratty. And like, they're just growing up in the world that they've been given.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and they're...
Think about it.
imagine trying to get through your life after social media. You know, if social media had been around all this time, if you were, you know, imagine being a 13-year-old in middle school or high school and being made fun of, not just by the kid in this one class, but online and mocked all over school for things, you know, like.
Oh, yeah. If AOL had come out like a couple years before, like a certain, you know, like a 2-3 years before, then I probably wouldn't have, you know, I probably wouldn't have been taken out of my home when I was 7. Right. Yeah. You'll have to listen to the first season. Like I'll talk about it. It's kind of funny, but like not, you know, like us traumatized kids, like we can laugh about this stuff.
Right.
But, you know, like, yeah, if I'd had the internet, I mean, things would have been really different for me. And so I try not to give my kids such a hard time because, yeah, it is the world they've been given. And on the other hand, it's like they're also doing things like I couldn't afford to go to school for on the iPad. And they're just like, right. my son, he's like DJing it up. And he's like, Mom, I'm gonna write you a song for your show. And I was like, do it, man. Go for it. You know, but like, you know, the parental settings are on, you know.
Absolutely. The world is so much more open to them in that regard. And to all of us, you mm-hmm. know, this is a perfect example. If you wanted to do this show on the radio 30 years ago, you would have. I got offered a radio show at one point and I'm like, oh, yeah, look at me. And then it dawned, like once they explained it to me, it was, yeah, if you can go get this much advertising money
yeah.
for a show, then we'll give you an hour slot. And yeah. I was like, wait a minute, you guys said you just really liked me. Like, I don't think you even know me.
Yeah.
But now if you think you have something to say, if you think you're funny, you can, it's simple as go to Twitter and be funny and get famous for being funny on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
If you can make memes that people like and enjoy and laugh at, you can make a name for yourself. If you're a singer, you don't have to go through the gatekeepers of music anymore. You don't have to go through the yeah. gatekeepers of Hollywood or TV. You can make your creation and put it on YouTube. You can put it on your own site. You don't even have to go through YouTube. Mm-hmm. But it's like that's what always drew me to the internet. What I love about it, I think it was a meritocracy. I think it's becoming a little different now. But ultimately, if you make something that people want, there's no one to stop you from getting it out there anymore.
Yeah, nobody.
You know,
just take it from me. Like, seriously, just take it from me. I mean, when I wanted to do this, I was like, oh, this is going to get lost in some hole on the internet. You know, nobody's going to find it, you know, or it's going to take years for it to catch on. And, you know, once I just started saying what I was doing, be like, yeah, my podcast is estrangement. And I was expecting the normal, like, oh, that sucks, you know, but people were like, what? You know, like, you're talking about that? Yeah. And so it's kind of cool. I've been getting a lot of encouragement and stuff like that. And so, yeah, it's like, if you want to do something, do it. It's like, I was always afraid to be in front of people, but I did have talent and I didn't want to waste it. And everybody's like, you should use it. You should use it. And I said, well, I don't know what to do. I'm kind of afraid of people and I'm introverted, but I love talking with people. And I just feel like the more and more I do this, I feel like this is what I'm supposed to do. It's really weird. It's really cool.
It's, it's fun.
Yeah, again, it is fun.
It's therapeutic. And it gives me, you know, gives me, and obviously I think yours is going to be way more produced than mine. Mine.
But you mine will is, too, though, because you're going to get, you know, we're going to pitch you.
Well, it's funny. This will be the first time that mine gets pitched, because again, I don't tell people. I think I was six episodes in before my wife realized I was doing it.
Really?
Well, no, she knew because I actually bought, like,
yeah,
I spent a couple grand on equipment and a nice computer.
Yeah,
and
I'm sure that didn't go past her so easy.
Right. But hey, she if it's something I wanted to do and try, mm-hmm, and she didn't bat an eye. You know, yeah, she's been with me every step of the way. She'll never show up on the show. She has no interest in that.
So, well, if you wanted to take a couple minutes and kind of maybe give it a little pitch.
I would love it if people followed me on Twitter. I'm at Kerouac Smith, Kerouac Smith. And you can find my podcast on all the places you find them, all the podcatchers, is Kerouac to the Future. We do it. I say we because in my last six or seven, I've got a co-host, Shotgun Mike Hostetler, who is a bizarro person. And we hang out, we have fun, we talk about, lately we talk about movies, all the Marvel movies, we talk about comic books, we watch strange movies like An Evening with Beverly Loughlin is a great indie movie that came out, mm-hmm, sort of last year. Didn't actually play anywhere, but it's on demand and it was great. And you know, mm-hmm, then occasionally we, you know, we'll stop and we'll talk about abortion or Ocasio-Cortez and the, you know, the hypocrisy around, mm-hmm, around the people that say things about her, or we'll talk about the Covington Catholic kids and then never release it because we don't want to call 16-year-olds assholes. And but you know, we did it and didn't release it, and that's the therapy part for that one.
Yeah. It's like sometimes you say things that, you know, are just coming out because it's what you feel in the moment. You know, it's not necessarily what your code of ethics is. And you know, that's another thing. It's like, I hope that our listeners can be very forgiving. This is very, very difficult to talk about all this stuff.
Right.
You know, this kind of thing.
Well, remember, but, when it comes to all this, I'm the one who's like the pro estrangement cheerleader. If you can, if estrangement will make your life better, then go for it with no apologies. Like in my book, like if you need to get away from a toxic person, like you don't need to think about that they're their father, mother, sister, brother, whatever, husband, wife. You should estrange yourself from people who have a negative effect on you. And just like my mom, they can. If they redeem themselves, or if, mm-hmm, your view changes somehow, if you, you know, you realize, oh, you know what, I was an asshole when I was a kid, like that, maybe you're the one that needs to come back in that situation. But I think we know what we are, and admitting it to ourselves and admitting what other people are to us for real,
mm-hmm,
like, I think it's an empowering thing, and it's made my life better. It made my life better doing it. It made my life better forgiving one, and it keeps my life better continuing another.
Well, it was so great to have you on my
Thank
show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. It's nice to say all this all together for the first time, probably.
Really?
I think so. I don't think I've ever gone that in depth all at once.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Your wife will have to listen.
Right, she will. She would listen to this one.
She's probably like, I never knew that. You never told me.
She'll want to know who the other person who knows that I begged for food at Wendy's.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you for coming on the show again. You are listening to When the Bow Breaks.